Welcome to this Horizon Guides podcast. I'm Karen Filfalan, editor at Horizon Guides, and today we'll be examining what it's like to see the endangered mountain gorilla in its natural habitat. There are just over 1,000 mountain gorillas left in existence, spread across the rainforests of Rwanda, Uganda, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Decades of conservation efforts have seen numbers of mountain gorillas increase, and the money brought in by tourism has had a direct impact on this. Today, we'll be speaking to Ian Redman, chairman of the Ape Alliance and a field biologist and conservationist who has worked with gorillas for more than 30 years. Ian was one of the researchers who led Sir David Attenborough to the gorillas in the famous Life on Earth documentary and spent many years working with acclaimed primatologist Diane Fossey. In this podcast, Ian explains exactly how it feels to encounter a mountain gorilla, recalls what has changed for the gorilla families Attenborough met, and looks at how tourism is aiding conservation. Enjoy the episode.
Ian, welcome to this Horizon Guides podcast. I thought a good place to start would just be for you to describe what it's like to see a mountain gorilla up close, and then maybe say a little bit about what it is that about these animals that actually fascinates you.
Well, mountain gorillas, as most people will know, are among our closest relatives in the animal kingdom. So when you meet one, it is, from the point of view of a naturalist, is fascinating because you see their shape, their behavior, and you see so many elements of what you previously perhaps thought of as human behavior in what they do. And so that makes a much more profound appreciation, because suddenly you start to think, oh, wait a minute, we are human beings. And when you exchange a glance with a gorilla and you see the mind behind the eyes, you kind of realize, oh yeah, that there are other beings, non-human beings, gorilla beings. And if you're lucky enough to meet other more different species like elephants or whales and dolphins, you realize there are many kinds of beings on this world. And most people are so hooked up, they think human being is one word, but of course it's two. And that's on a very profound level what makes meeting gorillas in their natural habitat so moving.
And you've worked in gorilla conservation for many years. I want to take you back to kind of the beginning. Now, you were there in 1978, I think, working as a research assistant to Diane Fossey when Sir David Attenborough filmed Life on Earth.
This year is 40 years since the broadcast of that landmark series on the BBC, but it was a year before that the filming was done.
Took place.
So, yes, I went to work with Diane Fossey in 1976. As a sort of general research assistant, dog's body, gopher, and in January 1978, Diane told me to gopher the BBC, and I went down to Kigali and managed to find these two English blokes walking down the road chatting, and I said, "You sound English, are you by any chance from the BBC?" And they said, "Yes." "Great, you're the people I'm looking for." So it was that well organised. And the filming of Life on Earth, which many people will have seen as clips, but you have to remember that was a short sequence towards the end of a 13-part series. So 13 hours of amazing, groundbreaking television. And it must be very frustrating for the thousands of other scientists that helped the Attenborough team film everything from corals to giraffes. And the only thing anyone talks about is the gorilla sequence. So it was extraordinarily good luck for me to happen to be the gopher and to meet David and the film crew and take them out to the gorillas and introduce them and give them exactly the same experience that now anyone can have, with the exception being, the one difference being, that today we try our utmost to maintain a 7-meter distance between the gorillas and the visitors. Whereas in those days, there were no rules. And when a gorilla came and sat on David Attenborough, the directors said to the cameraman, "Well, you know, it's not in the script, but film this because it'll give the lads in the cutting room a bit of a laugh." And that's how the famous sequence of a juvenile called Pablo sitting in David Attenborough's lap made television history. Almost, you know, it wasn't on the script. And in those days, because they were filming literally with film, every 100 foot of film had to be accounted for. It wasn't like today where you can just run off and put a few more minutes on the hard drive because there's plenty of room. Every foot of film mattered then. But anyway, luckily, it was captured on camera and is now firmly in the minds of almost everyone who's seen it as a delightful experience. And it changed the public attitude to gorillas from being the kind of the horror movie monster animal to a friendly, benign, sort of shaggy vegetarian living up in the mountains who you'd actually quite like to get to know.
And for kind of our listeners today, that was the situation in the 70s, wasn't it? You know, the mountain gorilla wasn't seen in the way it is today. It, as you said, it was kind of King Kong, that kind of image that was projected from it.
Yes, until, well, George Schaller in 1959-1960 did the first study, and that was a one-year study, and that was considered to be a long-term field study in those days. Now, of course, we're 50 years into the study of mountain gorillas, and that's what we call a long-term field study. But until Schaller and then Diane Fossey, attitudes to gorillas, awareness of gorillas, were based largely on big game hunters who went out to shoot them. And when you're shooting at a family of gorillas, of course the silverback is going to come screaming and charging at you to defend his family. He'll probably die doing it. But if he doesn't, then he'll probably kill the hunter doing it. So it was a battle between traditional enemies. Humans and gorillas treated each other with fear and aggression. And it took this extraordinary American woman, Diane Fossey, the courage and time to come and sit and observe them and win their trust. And it's that method of winning their trust, the fact that you go into their habitat, make contact and reassure them. And Diane developed this method of using gorilla contact calls, little vocalizations, which they use to keep in touch with each other in dense vegetation when they can't see each other. You have a sort of a round of what are known as BVs, which stands for Belsch vocalization, because at first people just thought they were burping a lot. And then they realized, no, this is a deliberate sort of conversation to keep everyone informed where the group is, where different members of the group are. So you approach them and say, and then you wait for an answer. And often you get an answer. But if they suddenly realize it's a human and they're not used to tame humans, then they'll flee in terror. And you have to keep doing that day after day to get across to them that these humans are different. So the humans that know a little bit about gorilla etiquette and vocalizations can be trusted. And on that basis, the whole multi-million pound tourism industry has developed, because two American scientists, Bill Weber and Amy Vedder, used Diane's methods to get gorillas used to visitors, but not for research purposes, but for tourism. And every day, different humans, but all following the same rules of keeping sort of quiet and together and letting the gorillas know that you're there and not behaving in an aggressive way or a way that might be perceived as aggressive. So, you know, the first time someone sees a gorilla, almost certainly their arm's going to shoot up and say, "There's a gorilla!" to tell their friends that they've seen one. And that sudden action of waving your arm and vocalizing could be misconstrued. Although, again, the gorillas are so used to tourists now that you have to work quite hard to offend them. But in the early days, if they took offense, they would leave. And that would be the end of the tourist encounter. And that's not what you want. So the gorillas learned about human mannerisms and behavior. And the tourists are briefed very carefully before they go out to see the gorillas on what gorilla etiquette demands. And the guides, who are very skilled at managing this encounter between two traditional enemies who have come to a truce and now trust each other, they want to keep that trust, and it works amazingly well.
You talked a little bit there about the vocalizations and how the gorillas become habituated to some of the tour leaders. I mean, how else does their behavior change, and how long are gorillas habituated before they are being introduced to kind of tour groups?
Well, it rather depends on the character of the silverback, and to some extent of his females. So sometimes if an unhabituated female joins a habituated silverback, she's terrified when she sees a human and gives an alarm bark, and he looks around and says, "But they're always coming. Don't worry." And it takes a while for her to get used to the fact that the silverback is very relaxed with human visitors. But it depends, but likely a year or two. And in fact, in Windi in Uganda now, you can take part in the habituation process and spend longer with the gorillas than you can with a normal visit, because they want gorillas to get used to humans that currently aren't. And by having a group of visitors sort of follow at a distance and just be around, they get the gorillas used to the idea that, that these humans are okay. It's a constantly evolving situation from abject terror and flight, just running away at high speed. When you meet gorillas that are have only seen humans as aggressors, to a reluctant acceptance, but often with alarm barks or some what is known as observer orientated behavior. And the ideal is that you're approaching the gorillas and you're not affecting their behavior, and you can just observe them. From a scientific point of view, that's what you want. You want to be a fly on the wall. But the gorillas can see you're not a fly. You're a very gorilla-like animal, but you tend to stand bipedally, which for a gorilla is trying to intimidate others. So when a gorilla stands on two legs, they're saying how big and strong I am, and perhaps beating their chest or displaying in some way. So when you're first getting to know gorillas that don't understand about friendly humans, keeping low so that you're not towering over them, meeting them on the same eye line, is a part of that process. And you use your body language and your positional, the way you hold yourself, to convey harmlessness. You might sit with your arms folded rather than elbows apart. You might look away when the gorillas look at you, so you're not staring at them. And all those little signals are indicative to a gorilla that you're not being aggressive, because many of their signals and body language reflect our own. So you can use that shared understanding of gesture and position to convey a friendly approach, a non-aggressive approach, and within a relatively short time. I've used those methods with completely unhabituated gorillas and had what I would describe as a conversation over some time. If you just walk near a family of gorillas that are not used to friendly humans, they will flee in abject terror. And that's the end of the conversation. But if you can do something which gets their curiosity, then you can extend that conversation. And as I say, by perhaps crawling forwards, lying down, scratching yourself in a very relaxed and, you're trying to distract their attention from the fact that you're human and let them see that common heritage that we have. So you can use the behaviors we have in common, such as sort of scratching, relaxing, lying down, hands behind your head. Gorillas do that. And when they see a human doing that, it's very obvious that the human isn't attacking them. So what's it doing? And then once you've got their curiosity, you're halfway there.
And when you're with a group of gorillas, how do they socialize between themselves? You know, what can people expect to see?
It's a bit like joining a family picnic, because usually by the time a group of tourists get to the gorillas, they will have finished their morning feeding and have settled down for their sort of mid to late morning siesta. And so there will be adults sitting around. They'll build themselves a little day nest to be comfortable, and they might groom each other or just snooze in the sunshine with a belly full of salad, because they spent the previous 2 or 3 hours selecting, preparing and eating little handfuls of food. So you arrive when things are very chilled. If they're still feeding when you get there, I usually recommend to the tourists that even though they really, really want to see the gorillas, that we hold back a little bit until they settle down. Because once they're in their rest period, then they're not moving. And when they're not moving, you have time to find the best position to avoid thick vegetation and see the gorillas. Whereas when they're feeding, they tend to spread out when they feed. So there's one over here, there's one over there, there's one some distance away. And so you're only going to see one or two at a time. And because when they've finished eating what there is just around them, they get up and move to the next feeding site. And it feels like you're pushing them because they're always moving away from you. In fact, they'd be moving whether you were there or not, but it's a different sense than if you arrive when they're starting their rest period and they're not going anywhere. They're just relaxing. And the kids, of course, have got lots of energy. They don't relax, they play. So watching adults sitting around snoozing or grooming each other and kids climbing trees and playing and chasing and wrestling, jumping up and down on dad, all those lovely little scenes that I have in my mind from many, many gorilla contacts are what I hope that a visitor I'm taking will get to experience, because it is sharing something that is absolutely delightful to watch. And as I say, philosophically, it can change people's perception of themselves and our place in nature.
And just expand that a little bit. How can it change people's perception?
I guess a lot of people who come to see gorillas will have watched documentaries and will probably have a greater knowledge of gorilla behavior than any previous generation. But it's one thing to watch it on a screen across your sitting room, or these days in a small screen in the palm of your hand. and quite another thing to have that completely immersive experience when the birds are singing, either the rain's falling or the sun's shining. They do live in a montane rainforest, so it's quite often wet up there. But with climate change, the dry season is much longer and much drier. So there are changes afoot. But being there, and you don't know whether a gorilla is going to come up behind you because the group is spread out and you're with one part of the group. It's a wonderful experience in the literal sense of inspiring wonder. It fills you with wonder that you are there a few yards away from a family of gorillas who don't mind you being there. And much of the time they'll probably ignore you, and you might feel, well, I know I want to communicate with them. But occasionally somebody looks over and you catch their eye. I just exchanged a glance with the gorilla. That's as David Attenborough famously said in his Life on Earth piece to camera, exchanging a glance with the gorilla is different from other animals. I suppose you should broaden that to other great apes as well, because if you exchange a glance with a chimpanzee, an orangutan, or a bonobo, it's the same thing. There is a mind behind the eyes. I think it's a mixture of many emotions, but for many people who I take on special interest tours, it's something they've wanted to do all their life. It's on their bucket list. So you see tears, you see real emotion sometimes, and you see an awful lot of taking of photographs and videos. And one thing I always do before the end of a contact, if they're there for an hour, by 50-55 minutes, if they haven't put the camera down, I say, look, just look with your eyes and feel with all your senses, because the photographs will be a souvenir. But if you haven't actually experienced it away from the camera, you don't remember what you've seen, because you're seeing it all through a viewfinder. So yes, it's a wonderful privilege to be able to share that experience with other people, particularly when they really value it. And the fact that moment of revelation almost is something that people are prepared to pay significant sums of money to enjoy has meant that mountain gorillas, which at the end of the last century looked like they were going to be extinct within a very short time, are now increasing in number every year. And mountain gorillas are the only ape, apart from the human species, that is increasing in number every year. But they've just got into four figures. There's just over 1,000 mountain gorillas, and we're up at 7 and a bit billion. So there's a long way to go to let them recover their numbers and be absolutely secure, particularly when the traditional threats they faced of habitat loss and hunting and sort of incidental catch in snares set for antelope, which can maim and injure and even kill young gorillas. Those threats have diminished as the conservation has improved. But the new threat is that we change the global climate patterns and it stops raining in those mountains, and that would be devastating, because of course without rain there wouldn't be a rainforest, and without a rainforest there wouldn't be gorillas, and to some extent without gorillas there wouldn't be the same rainforest, because they are such important species in the ecology of those forests.
So you've spoken a little bit there about obviously how important the money from tourism is to gorilla conservation. I mean, how does it impact directly on the gorillas and also on climate change?
Well, the revenues from tourist ticket sales, the permits to go and see gorillas and chimpanzees and other species that have this high value tourism price, those clearly go to fund the conservation in the national park. So mountain gorillas only live in national parks, which are also World Heritage Sites, so they have the highest level of legal protection. And to protect them from illegal activities, hunting, woodcutting, illegal collection of honey from the forest, which is dangerous because people burn out the trees to get the bees out of the hive to collect the honey, and the burning trees can cause forest fires. All those things have been addressed by conservation non-governmental organizations like the Gorilla Organization or Fauna and Flora International, these various groups that have been working around the mountain gorilla habitat for decades. But now that the governments use a proportion of the revenue from gorilla permits to fund community projects. So increasingly people who live around the gorilla habitat recognize that not only do some people get jobs in the park or in the hotels or as musicians entertaining the tourists or as craftspeople creating beautiful objects to sell to the tourists, all those are sort of incidental income from the tourism, but the actual permits, a percentage of that goes to community projects. So if a community wants a new school or clinic or corn mill or whatever their need is, that gorilla money helps provide that for everyone in the community. So it's a very positive impact on people's lives, and it's now become a sort of a case study for poverty alleviation through conservation. It is a very impressive success story. The disappointing fact is that earlier this year I took some journalists to see the gorillas to track down the gorillas who met David Attenborough. And in fact, we were tracking down the children and grandchildren of the gorillas who met David Attenborough 40 years ago. But it was a salutary experience, because on the second day, they met an anti-poaching patrol come out with a handful of snares. Now, a few years ago, they might have had dozens of snares. So the fact that it was down to a handful is great. But that handful means that there are some families who still think actually nipping into the park and setting snares to catch antelope, even though it risks baby gorillas' lives, is worth it because my family circumstances are such that I need that extra income. And in both Rwanda and Uganda, and although the tourists don't often go into the DRC, they could if they prepare to ignore the Foreign Office travel advisory. you get just as warm a welcome from the guides, just as professional and experienced in being taken out to the gorillas, and just as welcoming families of gorillas in the Congo. It's just that most people don't go there. But in all those three countries that share the mountain gorilla habitat, the conservation is a really important part of lifting people out of rural poverty and giving them better options in life than illegally cutting wood or bamboo or setting snares or burning out wild beehives. So you'll see a lot of the conservation groups are funding beekeeping organizations and teaching people how to market their honey and buying honey that the bees have collected from the national park where the gorillas live gives you a very direct ecological link to the gorillas with only a positive impact on them and also a positive impact on the family whose livelihoods have been improved by a little bit of advice on how better to keep bees on the edge of the park rather than go in and burn out trees and risk the park to catch wild honey. And it's a sort of win-win-win situation. The gorillas benefit, the ecology of the park benefits, and the communities that live around the park benefit.
And you talked there about visiting the gorilla families that Attenborough encountered in the 70s. I mean, what has happened to those gorilla families? How has gorilla conservation changed over those years as well?
Well, when the BBC arrived in January 1978, we had just experienced a poaching attack where a young silverback called Digit was killed by poachers, and I found his body. I'd known Digit for a little over a year and regarded him as a friend, in the sense that he would choose to come and sit near me and watch what I was doing, and I was there to watch what he was doing and the rest of the gorillas were doing. And it was, I think it was an interspecies friendship. He got to know me. He seemed to enjoy my company. He didn't have any peers of the same age, so he didn't have a sort of a wrestling partner. And he did occasionally thump me, but in a friendly way. So it was one of my first gorilla friendships, and finding his body. And I first of all turned the body to look to see who it was, and there was no head. So I couldn't see his face because his head had been cut off. But he was called Digit because one of his fingers stuck out at a funny angle, possibly the result of a snare injury as a child. And so I picked up his arm to look for his crooked finger, and again, no hand, because the hands had been cut off. So at that time, one of the threats to the gorillas was that visitors to Rwanda would buy mummified gorilla hands or gorilla skulls as kind of curios. And as a naturalist, I can see the interest in a skull. You know, if I found a gorilla skull, I'd want to closely examine it. But I know now that if I were to buy that, I'm essentially encouraging someone to go out and kill another one. And they're not going to say, oh, I just killed this endangered species. They'll say, oh, I found this in the forest. Do you want to buy it? And again, your first thought, if you're interested in anatomy or natural history, is, yes, I'd love to have that on my mantelpiece. But you have to understand that if you do that, then especially if you pay for it, you're encouraging others to go and collect more skulls and not necessarily wait for the animal to die of natural causes. So at that time, it was dire. Poachers were killing gorillas. They were setting snares for bushmeat. They were harvesting non-timber forest products and even some timber products. There was some cutting of trees in the national park because there wasn't the money to patrol the park. There wasn't the motivation or the training or the understanding to protect this important forest that sits on mountains that holds the rainwater during the rainy season and releases it slowly during the dry season. So you have year-round water. That's a really important ecological service that those forests where the gorillas live provide to all the people who live around that forest. And you're dealing with one of the most densely populated parts of rural Africa around the mountain gorilla habitat. But few people had an understanding that every time they cleared another patch of forest, they were actually turning the tap off their year-round water supply. But that changed with the conservation education. And now there's a widespread understanding of the importance of the gorillas, mostly, I think, coloured by the revenues that they generate from tourism. But I think there's also, particularly in this time of awareness of climate change, you know, the mountain gorilla habitat has some deep peat swamps, and peat is a carbon store. And all the trees and roots, of course, are storing carbon. And the plants in the mountains that depend on gorillas for seed dispersal are tied to the gorillas. So you protect the gorillas. They are like the gardeners of the forest. And if you hashtag gardeners of the forest, you'll find all sorts of articles online about this role that gorillas and elephants and other animals that eat fruit that then disperse the seeds in their droppings. That's what they do in a forest. They keep the forest healthy. And I think there is an increasing awareness of that because we're trying to prevent dangerous climate change. And therefore, these forests are seen as important as to sequester and store carbon. But also, they generate rainfall and they control the runoff of rainfall so that it flows throughout the year. So I think there is increasingly an awareness of wilderness areas are not just wasteland waiting for humans to clear them and cultivate and make into something productive. They're actually part of the life support system of the planet. And in the 10 countries in Africa that gorillas live, the gorillas are keystone species in those forests, which play a globally important role. So we should, when we appreciate gorillas, not just see them, oh, they share some DNA with us, that's interesting, or, oh, they're nice to see on holiday. Yes, they are, but they're also playing a role in the ecology of these forests, which play a role in the health of the biosphere, the whole planet, at least the thin film of the planet of atmosphere and water in which we live.
Over the many decades that you've been researching and working with the gorillas, is there one moment or one of many moments that perhaps you could pick out as one of your most memorable experiences?
Well, I suppose introducing David Attenborough to the gorillas must be up there among them, partly because he and the cameraman, Martin Saunders, sadly no longer with us, Martin said, oh, I'm sure I'm going to get good stuff. I've got a 600 millimeter lens. I said, Martin, you're going to be filming eyeballs, because there wasn't an understanding that you might sit next to the gorillas. But yeah, that was a memorable moment. But that was more a human orientated moment. What about the gorillas? I think times when I've sat with them on my own and they've been all asleep around me and dozing in the sunshine, and that complete trust that, yes, I'm a human, I'm a different being to them, but they're accepting of me because they got to know me. And then there were points when individuals came over and clearly were curious about me. I've had gorillas closely examine me with the same sort of curiosity that I have about other species. So I think gorillas share that human-like curiosity as well as our anatomical features that we have in common. And being the object of study of a gorilla naturalist, looking at how we differ from them, is quite special. But of course, that isn't something that we can allow to happen now, because people are coming from all over the world, possibly carrying flu or cold viruses and germs, and you don't want the gorillas to suffer from that. So even though those memories were close contact was possible, because I was sort of in self-imposed quarantine, living in a hut on the mountains, not being exposed to new pathogens. These days, with people coming by the thousand from all over the world to experience seeing gorillas in the natural habitat, we have to maintain that 7 meter distance, which you can explain to the tourists, and most tourists really don't want to do anything that would risk the gorillas, so they'll go along with it. But the gorillas still want to come and play with the tourists, so you sometimes have to dissuade the gorillas from coming too close to you. And there have been some lovely occasions where people are looking at the gorillas in one direction, and a blackback male, a young adolescent male, comes up behind us because he's going to the other gorillas and we happen to be in the way, and you just have to explain to people, just get off the path, let him pass, and he'll sort of elbow by. And that moment, particularly if it's captured on camera, is what everyone wants to put on their social media feed, which is understandable, but then it encourages everyone to think, oh, touching a gorilla is the goal of gorilla tourism, whereas actually no, observing from a safe distance, safe from the gorilla's point of view as well as from the human's point of view, is what we're trying to achieve.
Ian, that's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for asking.
Thanks for listening to this Horizon Guides podcast. If you enjoyed the episode, you can read more about how to see mountain gorillas in Uganda and Rwanda, including downloading our free guide to walking with gorillas, on www.horizonguides.com. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Horizon Guides too. We look forward to bringing you another episode very soon.